From Pacifica Radio, today in San Francisco, this is Democracy Now!
I'm still on death row, in every sense of the word. I'm on a death row unit, I'm in a death row cell, I'm surrounded by guys, about 24 on a pod on death row, you know, 22 and 2 is the same goes. 22 hours in, and if you want to go out, 2 hours out.
From death row, we speak with Mumia Abu-Jamal. From prison in Pennsylvania to child prisons in California.
California has youth prisons that are literally factories of misery and abuse. Now we have a videotaped Rodney King-style beating of a child behind bars and a new movement to shut down the California Youth Authority.
And six international aid workers who were held hostage in Fallujah are released and blast the U.S. We'll get an on-the-ground report from Iraq.
We used a loudspeaker to identify ourselves. We were dressed in bright blue medical outfits and we had our passports in our hands with our hands in the air. Then we stepped forward into the street with our hands in the air. We were walking down away from where the soldiers were stationed. We didn't realize that, and they ended up shooting towards our backs.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, broadcasting from San Francisco. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration is being widely criticized around the world for backing an Israeli, the West Bank while delaying the Palestinians as a right to return to their former homeland. President Bush says that he is endorsing the plan on Wednesday during a meeting in Washington with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Never before has an American president openly backed Israel's building of settlements in the occupied territories. Another part of the plan calls for Israel to pull completely out of the Gaza Strip. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kurey said, quote, "This is a catastrophe that has to be dealt with. What is fixed is that we have rights and we will defend them." Again, the U.S. being widely criticized around the world for backing an Israeli plan that will allow Israel to keep large areas of the West Bank while denying Palestinians a right of return to their former homeland. President Bush endorsing the plan on Wednesday during a meeting in Washington with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Never before has an American president openly backed Israel's building of settlements in the occupied territories. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan criticized Bush for ignoring the wishes of Palestinians, while the European Union said it would only accept such a plan if both the Israelis and the Palestinians agreed to it. The head of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, said Bush's move, quote, cancels all frameworks and it represents dangerous developments in the Arab-Israeli conflict. The Lebanese president, Emil Ahoud, added, quote, it undermines hope for a just and comprehensive peace, inflames feelings of enmity toward America, and opens the door toward retaking these rights by force through all legitimate means of resistance. The Guardian of London reports British Prime Minister Tony Blair will ask Bush today to take a more even-handed approach to the Israeli-Palestinian situation. Blair's in Washington for a special summit with Bush. The increasing resistance in Iraq against the U.S. occupation has forced the Pentagon to extend the stay of 20,000 U.S. troops who are scheduled to leave soon for home. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made the announcement Thursday as he admitted the U.S. had not anticipated the recent level of violence. 93 U.S. troops have died so far in April. He said, quote, I certainly would not have estimated that we would have had the number of individuals lost. In Fallujah, hospital officials are reporting another 15 Iraqis have been killed by U.S. forces. This comes as the United Nations top advisor in Iraq is criticizing the U.S. for its attack on Fallujah. Over 600 Iraqis have been killed over the past week. The UN advisor, Lakhdar Brahimi, said, quote, "The collective punishments are not acceptable, cannot be acceptable, and to cordon off and besiege a city is not acceptable. There is no military solution to the problems, and the use of force, especially use of excessive force, makes matters worse." Meanwhile, Brahimi has proposed a possible way for the U.S. to hand over power in Iraq after June 30th. Under the proposal, the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council would be dissolved and replaced by a transitional government appointed by the United Nations. The Bush administration has backed the plan, which would allow the U.S. to remain in charge of military and security matters. In other news from Iraq, a senior Iranian diplomat was assassinated Thursday, a day after he was sent to Iraq to head an Iranian delegation that was negotiating a truce between the United States and Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr. The United Nations Nuclear Watch Group is reporting the U.S. has left some Iraqi nuclear facilities unguarded, allowing radioactive materials to be taken out of the country. The International Atomic Energy Agency sent the U.S. a letter outlining their findings 3 weeks ago. The Bush administration has yet to respond. And the three Japanese civilians who were taken hostage last week in Iraq were released unharmed Thursday in Baghdad. The Associated Press is reporting a senior intelligence official has come forward to reveal that the CIA warned as early as 1995 that Islamic fundamentalists were likely to use planes to carry out attacks against U.S. landmarks in Washington, D.C. and New York. And by 1997, the CIA had identified Osama bin Laden's intent to attack the United States. The official disclosed information contained in the classified national intelligence estimate of 1995 and 1997. The release of information came less than a day after the 9/11 Commission criticized the CIA for failing to recognize al-Qaeda as a formal terrorist organization until 1999. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting the White House may preempt the September 11th Commission's final report this summer by embracing a proposal to create a powerful new post of Director of National Intelligence. This, according to administration officials, the director would be put in charge of the government's 15 different intelligence agencies. And European nations have rejected a truce purportedly offered by Osama bin Laden in a new 7-minute tape that was aired on Al Arabiya News Network. Bin Laden offered the truce to any European country that ends military operations in Muslim nations. The CIA is saying the tape is probably authentic. The Environmental Protection Agency has determined that more than one half of the country lives in areas with air quality below federal standards. A total of 474 counties are being cited for having too much smog causing pollution. The dirtiest sections identified were all in California. We'll have more on this story later in the program. In South Africa, the African National Congress strengthened its power in the country's parliament this week by winning 70% in an election that marked the 10th anniversary of the ANC's historic rise to power in post-apartheid South Africa. In South Korea, the liberal Uri Party has won a majority of seats in the country's National Assembly in what the Washington Post describes as the country's sharpest shift to the left in four decades. The election results are seen as a response to conservative lawmakers' vote last month to impeach the South Korean president. In campaign news, Senator John Kerry accused President Bush of manipulating fears about security for political gain. Kerry said, quote, home base for George Bush, as we saw to the nth degree in the press conference, is terror. Ask him a question, he's going to terror.
They got a war for oil, a war for gold, a war for money, and a war for souls. A war on terror, a war on drugs, a war on kindness, a war on hugs. A war on birds and a war on bees. They got a war on hippies trying to save the trees. A war with jets and a war with missiles. A war with high-seated government officials. Wall Street war on high finance. A war on people who just love to dance. A war on music. A war on speech. A war on teachers and the things they teach. A war for the last 500 years. War is just messing up the atmosphere. A war on Muslims. A war on Jews. A war on Christians and Hindus. A whole lot of people saying kill them all. They got a war on Mumia Abu-Jamal. The war on pot is a war that's failed. A war that's filling up the nation's jails. World War I, II, III, and IV, chemical weapons, biological war, Bush War I and Bush War II, they got a war for me, they got a war for you. Bomb, bomb.
That is Michael Franti here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. He came out last night as we rolled out the exception to the Ruler's Tour in Berkeley, California, celebrating 55 years of Pacifica Radio. This is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from San Francisco. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday at 3 p.m., 55 years before, Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica Radio, went on the airwaves and welcomed the Bay Area to KPFA. It was the beginning of what he called the Noble Experiment, an idea that he had been thinking about in detention. As a conscientious objector, he refused to fight in World War II, and when he came out, he said there has to be a media outlet not run by corporations that beat the drums for war, but run by journalists and artists. And that's how Pacifica Radio was founded. Not run by corporations that, as George Gerbner, founder of the Cultural Environment Movement, said, not run by corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so it was 3 o'clock on April 15th, 1949, that Lou Hill went on the air and welcomed the world to KPFA and Pacifica Radio. Yesterday at 3 o'clock, I visited the Prison Radio Project in San Francisco. The phone rang, and Mumia Abu-Jamal was on the line, a prisoner on death row in Pennsylvania. In 1981, he was convicted of killing a police officer, Daniel Faulkner, in a trial that human rights groups around the world have described as deeply flawed. He was convicted of the murder and sentenced to die. Mumia Abu-Jamal has been on death row for more than 20 years. Yesterday at 3 o'clock, he phoned in to the Prison Radio Project. We were able to speak with him for only 15 minutes until the line was cut off.
Hello?
You have a collect call from
Mumia Jamal,
an inmate at the State Correctional Institution at
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording. Custom calling features are not allowed during this conversation. The cost for this call is $4.35 for the first minute and 59 cents for each additional minute. If you do not wish to accept this call, please hang up now. To accept the call, press 0. Thank you for using
Verizon Select Services Incorporated.
Go ahead with your call.
On the move.
Hello, Mumia.
Hello.
Hi, this is Amy Goodman.
Hello, Amy. How are you?
Very good. Welcome to the airwaves of Democracy Now!
Well, welcome to hell.
You're still on death row, even though a judge more than 2 years ago, Federal Judge Yan, said that you had to be resentenced within 180 days. He overturned the death penalty, or you would be given life in prison. Why are you still there?
Well, it's something called an operation of law. the Commonwealth appealed virtually immediately, and that acted as a stay upon the judge's order. So it's almost as if there was no order at all.
Can you describe what it's like where you are?
Well, it isn't really difficult because it's the same it was before, you know. I'm still on death row in every sense of the word. I'm on a death row unit. I'm in a death row cell. I'm surrounded by guys, about 24 in a pod on death row. And, you know, 22 and 2, as the saying goes. 22 hours in, and if you want to go out, 2 hours out.
55 years ago today, at exactly this time, on April 15th, 1949, the conscientious objector Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica Radio, went on the air for the first time and welcomed people to a new station, KPFA, to a noble experiment that pioneered independent media in this country. Can you talk about how you get your voice out, the role of the independent press, as we have this conversation on the 55th anniversary of
this
Pacifica Radio?
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Well, it's probably very close to how you do it. I probably have considerably less resources, obviously, in both senses. But you wonder about the people that aren't being heard, and you listen for their voices. You listen for the people who call for help and are not heard, the people who are powerless, the people who are closest, really, to you and me, you know, average people. Most, as you, I think, very ably reported in your new book, most journalists really cater to the powerful. You know, they go to these dinners, you know, $100 a plate, $200 a plate. I think the one where you were supposed to be given the Indonesian award was like $1,500 a plate. I mean, come on. I mean, there's adequate press for those kinds of things and those kinds of people. There really isn't adequate press for the people without power, the people without influence, the people who are walking on the streets, the people who are terrified of losing their job or anxious about getting a job or fearing being kicked out of a house or living in a cage in a prison, or, you know. And those are the people who really go unheard, unseen, unappreciated. They're the people who are constantly at war for survival. And those are the voices, the human voices, that must be heard.
Mouly Abu-Jamal, you have written a new book, We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party. And before I ask you about your life in the Black Panther Party, which might well have played a role in your sentence to death, to the death penalty, I wanted to ask how you actually write your books. What is it like to write a book in prison?
Each one is really, I think, quite different. The first one, Life from Death Row, was written, virtually all of it, by hand. And it was a collection of essays, really. And someone had approached me and asked about, you know, doing some writing about things that were interesting to me, and I was writing a series of essays, and Noah Hanrahan just got together a bunch of them and said, oh, this will make a great book. I said, get out of here. And she really continued to fight and push and harangue, you know, that this was a great idea. She was right. I never believed it was a great idea because, you know, I didn't think it was such a big thing. I mean, I'm writing about average people, and it doesn't seem like it's anything extraordinary, you know. And each book is kind of developed on their own, in their own way. Today I might use a typewriter, but it's a solo effort, and it's done in a solitary, solemn situation. I just try to keep my eyes open and my ears open and to think about those stories that are untold, you know. My last two, the one you just named and Faith of Our Fathers before that, are my first works of history, where instead of looking at the present, I look at the past. Faith of Our Fathers looked at, I think, the last 500 years of African and African-American spiritual life in the Americas. And We Want Freedom looked at perhaps 30 years ago, the emergence, the development, and the denouement of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And those are voyages into the past, into history.
Can you talk about your life in the Black Panther Party, how old you were, and what this view of the Black Panther Party is that you want to convey from prison?
Well, when I joined, I was had just turned 15 or 14, I believe, and I had the pleasure of serving not just in Philadelphia, but in the Bronx, in New York, and in the national office in Berkeley, right outside of Oakland in California. And I met some really pretty remarkable people. And in all of my readings, and I've read most, certainly not all, but most.
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
We didn't know that, right? I read most of the books about the Black Panther Party, and I felt, really, that important stories were not told. Most of them had to do with the women in the party. And while there were women who wrote about their own experiences in the party, there was no one who wrote about average, less well-known, everyday women who were members of the Black Panther Party, who really were the soul, the spirit, you know, the backbone of the party. You know, everybody knows about Huey, and everybody knows about Eldridge, and if you talk about women in the party, everybody will tell you about Kathleen or maybe Elaine Brown, but, you know, everyday women really held that organization together, worked the programs, motivated people, went out into the community to do community work. You know, people like Safia Bukhari and, you know, hundreds, thousands of other women who virtually remain nameless. And I guess that was the impetus to tell that story. And I hope I did it well.
Right now, Mumia Abu-Jamal, there's a discussion after 9/11 whether there should be a domestic spy agency. You write about the Empire Striking Back. That's Chapter 6, COINTELPRO. Can you talk about its effect?
Well, COINTELPRO was really, I think, the beginning of what we're really facing now. Everything that was illegal 30 years ago, the stealing of mail, the illegal break-ins, what they used to call in the FBI jargon black bag jobs, all of those things were illegal back then. You know, the uses of informants and agents provocateurs to really destroy people's organizations who were working for, I'm putting quotes up with my hands, constitutional rights guaranteed by the First Amendment. All of those things were illegal. Many of the people who engaged in those acts on behalf of the government were warned by their supervisors, if you get caught, you're going to jail. These were FBI agents who were going around breaking into people's houses, looking all in their stuff and photographing stuff and, you know, framing people, everything. Well, that was illegal back then. But under the laws that have become law today, under the so-called Patriot Act, all of that becomes legal. You know, they can go in people's houses, they are taping people's phones, accessing computers, going through library records, and you know, building these files and infiltrating organizations and all of these kinds of things. But it's now under the protection of the so-called law. That's obscene. Mm-hmm. You know, and it shows you the lengths that people will go when they're motivated by fear. And I'll never forget, I was watching BET shortly after the Patriot Act passed, and a respected black member of the House of Representatives got on TV and he said, you know, I signed the law. Most of us in the House, we signed the bill. But I didn't read it. And I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, and the guy was saying, you know, we were told we have to do it now, and we have to do it immediately. And this was the time of the anthrax scares and all that kind of stuff. And they were so afraid of saying no, with the exception of Barbara Lee, you know, that they signed a law that essentially signed away certainly the Fourth Amendment, in some senses the First Amendment, in another sense the Sixth Amendment, when you think about people who don't have, you know, representation of any means, when the government can, you know, listen while you're talking with your lawyer. It's obscene. And it shows you how fear, once again, becomes the reigning principle in government, just as it was back during the COINTELPRO days, and indeed, when you go back further to the Palmer Raid days, you know, of Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman and so forth. When fear reigns, then rights go down the drain.
Mumia Abu-Jamal, we have a few more minutes, hopefully extended from that. But you wrote in All Things Censored. You've talked about your experience, for example, being on Democracy Now! And having the authorities rip the phone out from the wall. Can you describe what it's like to get word out?
In many ways, especially when I think I've...
This call is from a correctional institution and is subject to monitoring and recording.
I was saying, in many ways, especially when I think I've done a good commentary, a good story, it's liberating because you're sharing with people something that you think is important that may have a liberating effect or an enlightening effect on the people. Other ways, I'll never forget that experience to which you refer, because I remember, you know, I talked to some of your production people. You had me on hold for a minute. We got going, and I got into it, and all of a sudden, the phone went dead. And I was like, hello? 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 I thought it was like a technical problem, which sometimes happens. And I saw the guard, you know, just literally, give me the phone. Give me the phone. I'm like, well, what's up? Give me the phone. And he wouldn't tell me anything, but I gripped up a sergeant, and he said, look, I got a call from upstairs. It's as simple as that. That's the only thing I've ever heard.
You have 1 minute left to talk.
Maria, I just want to ask a question. Will you be able to call back for another 15 minutes?
No, the computer shuts down. After this call, I won't be able to call for another 24 hours. Anyone, anywhere.
Let me ask you one more question. Many people ask you, or ask, why you haven't openly denied that you killed a police officer. What is your response to that?
Well, the fact of the matter is that's not true. I have done that. I did it to the people where it mattered most. I did it to the jury that I was in front of. I told them that I was innocent. And that jury, the people who...
You have 15 seconds left to talk.
The 12 members of my jury who sentenced me to death, they heard that. They also heard the trial where I was essentially unrepresented.
Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from death row in Pennsylvania. At that point, the conversation cut off. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak with Van Jones, executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights here in San Francisco. Stay with us.
Hello, Earth children. This is your daddy calling here. You ain't been listening, so I thought I'd make myself more clear. It's been a long time since I left you with this home for you to care. Now I see you're weary, but I still need your help round here. Lifesaver, lifesaver, please don't surrender, 'cause I'm just holding on to you. I'm just holding on to you.
Michael Franti speaking and singing last night at a celebration of the 55th anniversary of Pacifica Radio, held at the King Junior High School in Berkeley, California. We are broadcasting live from San Francisco today. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. From death row in Pennsylvania, we move to the prison system in California, but not the adult prison system. Rather, the institutions here known as the California Youth Authority, or the CYA. Human rights activists call this system a factory of misery and child abuse. Well, the Books Not Bars campaign of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights recently announced a statewide day of action called Stop the Tragedies, Stop the Abuse. It begins on April 28th, a series of candlelight vigils that will be held across California to remember two teenagers who were both found hanged in the cell they shared in a CYA prison. California State Senator Gloria Romero recently released a video of California Youth Authority guards beating two boys inside the prison. The video shows the guards beating the boys long after they stop offering even meager resistance. We're joined right now by Van Jones. He is a lawyer and organizer and founder of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, which challenges human rights abuses within the U.S. criminal justice system. And it's a privilege to have you here, Van Jones.
Thank you very much.
Well, can you talk about this latest video and the situation of the California Youth Authority?
Yes. Well, first of all, we have this disgusting videotape. It's a Rodney King-style videotape beating. One of the young men is hit 28 separate times. 28 blows are landed against this child who's lying on his back with an adult straddling him and beating him. This kind of abuse, when we saw it as advocates, we were shocked. We showed it to young people who've been in the California Youth Authority. They looked at it and looked at it and went, well, where's the controversial part? This happens every day. This is the fabled California, the liberal state, the golden liberal California dream. The dark, sinister underbelly is this massive incarceration economy. California spends more money on prisons than any other state in the union. And the 10 youth prisons that we have now, as a result of a lawsuit, have been exposed as places where children are beaten. They're put in 4x4 cages. There are sexual assaults against these young people. And finally, the state legislature has begun to take notice and have hearings. But parents and children have been saying for now two decades that this is a horrendous, permanent feature of human rights abuses here in the United States, concentrated in the California Youth Authority. We are launching a campaign. The Books Not Bars campaign has been launched and will kick off officially on April the 28th to say, no more children should be so horrendously abused by adults in California that they will literally take their own lives. We have had two highly suspicious suicides, whether those children were murdered or whether they took their own lives. It is time to shut down the California Youth Authority. Youth prisons do not work. We are spending $80,000 per kid in the Youth Authority. It costs, you can send two kids to Yale for the cost of sending one kid to jail, and yet there's a 91% recidivism rate. It is an $80,000 prep school for adult prison where children are beaten and abused, and it's time to shut the California Youth Authority down and replace it with something more humane that's more effective.
Who is the most powerful lobby in the state for keeping the CYA?
the
prisons.
The California Prison Guards Union, the CCPLA, is the most powerful lobbying interest in Sacramento. They are such a powerful force, and they have such a stranglehold on the Democratic Party in this state, that California spends more money on prisons than Texas. And last year, when everybody was talking about, oh, the California budget crisis, this huge shortfall, the shortfall is bigger than the budget of most countries, while teachers were being given pink slips across the state, prison guards got a 7.5% pay raise. That's how powerful this union is, and they have a stake in maintaining these factories of abuse for these children. And we say no. We say that these, even Missouri, John Ashcroft, state of Missouri, has got enough sense to move into the 21st century. They don't put children in cages. They take the so-called worst offenders, the ones that everyone's so afraid of, they put them in regional rehabilitation centers. They give them therapy. It costs half of what we're spending, and they have a 70% success rate. We're spending twice as much with a 91% failure rate, and that is on a good day when there is no abuse. When we talk to young people, they say almost every day there are fights, beatings, and sexual assaults going on. So even if, but even if you could eliminate the abuse, the failure rate of this system, the money that's being spent that could be spent on teachers, coaches, counselors, art programs, the things that would turn these kids around, no. Those dollars are being robbed from the schools and spent on brutalizing young people, and we say it's time for it to stop.
How is a change in governorship from Gray Davis to Arnold Schwarzenegger affected or not affected the situation for kids in prison?
Well, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger ran for office priding himself on how he had been an advocate for inner city kids, and he's done all this for inner city kids, and he did a ballot measure to help inner city kids. Well, this is an opportunity for Arnold Schwarzenegger to actually stand up for inner city kids who are being beaten and brutalized and mistreated by people on Arnold Schwarzenegger's payroll, the people who are working at the California Youth Authority, and he has said nothing. He's convened a little blue ribbon commission to talk about it, but so far we've seen no action from this governor. The true hero in this is Senator Romero. The Latina legislature who stood up to the Prison Guards Union, she's demanded hearings on this, and she's been driving forward along with grassroots organizations this cause. But we've heard nothing encouraging from this so-called action hero. Let's see some heroic action for the kids in CYA, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Van Jones, has the fact that this is a presidential election year focused any attention on this nationally? For example, where does the Democratic candidate, John Kerry, stand on this issue?
Well, I mean, so far we've heard nothing encouraging from John Kerry on the question of juvenile or criminal justice. I think he's trying to duck it. The true heroes in this fight are the grassroots people, as they've always been. We have Kim McGillicuddy and Javier Storing in Los Angeles, leading the fight down there, working with young kids directly who've been impacted, who can speak for themselves. We have the prison law office that's filed lawsuit here, the National Council on Crime and Delinquency, Sandy Close with The Beat Within, Sue Burrell, who's one of the staunch heroes out of the Youth Law Center, David Steinhardt, who's been a warrior for us in Sacramento, the Let's Get Free Youth. You can go on and on and on naming the heroes at the grassroots level who have been fighting this fight and finally now are getting some attention. You cannot name, with the exception of Senator Romero, more than one or two elected officials who even now will take a public stand on the side of these kids. And John Kerry, the next time he comes to California, if he fails to speak out about this, I think it sends a very, very bad sign.
We're talking with Van Jones, the executive director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. We're going to have to break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the issue of green activism and communities of color in California, and we'll also look at the area, the San Joaquin Valley, and how it has become the place of the dirtiest air in this country. Also, very special thanks to Noel Hanrahan of the Prison Radio Project, who made possible the interview with Mumia Abu-Jamal. This is Democracy Now! Back in a moment.
We can chase down all our enemies, bring them to their knees. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. Whoa, we may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace. And I sing power to the peaceful. Let me hear y'all. Love to the peaceful. Put your hands together now. Power to the peaceful. Love to the peaceful, y'all. We may even find a solution to hunger and disease. We can bomb the world to pieces, but we can't bomb it into peace.
Michael Franti here on Democracy Now!, broadcasting from San Francisco. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Van Jones, Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, also joined on the line with us right now, Ray Leon. He is Policy Analyst for Environmental Health Issues, the new office of Latino Issues Forum in the San Joaquin Valley. Two nights ago, we kicked off our California Exception to the Rulers tour in Fresno, California, celebrating the community radio station there, KFCF. In the morning, I bumped into Ray on the street. He was most concerned with the latest findings that the San Joaquin Valley has the dirtiest air in the country. The Environmental Protection Agency said Thursday that nearly one in five counties across the U.S. has unacceptable levels of ozone, a major ingredient in smog, means over half the U.S. population is breathing unhealthy air, and it looks like the area around Fresno is the dirtiest. Ray Leon, can you talk about the effect? You've said the disproportionate effect of this kind of pollution on the Latino community in the San Joaquin Valley.
Good morning, Amy. Well, everybody knows that air pollution impacts everyone who has lungs, right? And that's true. It's impacting every resident in San Joaquin Valley. Specifically in terms of Latinos, it has a disproportionate impact because, on the most part, it is known that when you are low-income, when you are a person of color, you tend to live in the areas where you are at higher risk to diseases because you are nearer to sources of pollution. And in the San Joaquin Valley, which is, just to give an outlook of the San Joaquin Valley, it's the strongest, it's the greatest producer of harvest in the whole world, right? I'd like to say I'm from the community of here, on the farm worker community, where at the moment the lettuce season is taking place, and we ship lettuce to Japan, to China, to Mexico, all over the nation. And when it's melon season, we do the same. When it's cotton season, we do the same. In the valley, I'd like to say that we feed the world. But the problem is that in the valley, we have a huge amount of families that are going hungry. And poverty is an issue in the valley because a lot of people are farm workers. Most of those people that are farm workers are Latinos. And when you're a farm worker, Amy, of course, you know, you do not earn a living wage. You earn a minimum wage, which is barely enough to get by sometimes. And that it's a problem because also when you are a farm worker, you do not have health insurance. And so this compromises the situation of many of our valley residents, because when you get sick, what do? If your child gets an asthma attack, it's many times it's because they were never previously diagnosed because they didn't have access to that health care. And when a child gets an asthma attack, they end up in the emergency room. It's that much more expensive, and it's a further hindrance to the economic development of that family and just making it that much more difficult, destabilizing that family, destabilizing the communities, and destabilizing the whole valley, period, right? So the disproportionate impact is the fact that many of the Latinos do not have health insurance, the fact that many Latinos live near and are surrounded by pesticides, by dust, which, composed of what we call particulate matter, right? And new studies show that ozone actually causes asthma. It creates asthma. In the past, it was thought that asthma was something that was, on the most part, a gene that was inherited, and therefore the child would get asthma, the next generation would get asthma at some point in their life. Now, scientific studies show that actually ozone can create asthma in a healthy male. And in terms of particulate matter, the other part of air pollution, I mean, this is a particulate matter is basically the droplets of humidity that capture particles from of chemicals, from pesticides, from diesel fuel, from smoke, from just dust in the fields. And there's two types of PM, particulate matter, PM10 and PM2.5. Particulate matter is really dangerous because it is, I mean, there's also scientific studies coming out that tell us that particulate matter actually kills people. And in the valley alone, per year, 1,300 people die, and it is and the responsibility is on particulate matter that exacerbates and creates people's respiratory situation. Makes it into something worse to the extent in which they die. I mean, it increases cardiovascular and lung cancer, cardiovascular problems and lung cancer. So we're in a very bad situation here in the valley, especially now that I mean, it's not getting better. That's the problem. It's not getting better.
Ray Leon, I wanted to turn to Van Jones of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. You not only focus on criminal justice issues, you also have launched a whole green jobs campaign. What's the relation?
Well, I mean, exactly what the brother was talking about. The communities where there is over-incarceration and over-policing and overspending on so-called crime prevention, which is really just the economies of incarceration and supporting the incarceration industry. Those same communities are also the communities where there's excessive pollution, excessive toxics, cancer clusters, the asthma epidemic, birth defects. And so what the criminal justice movement is now doing is reaching out to the environmental justice movement. We should be one movement. We should come together under the banner of green jobs, not jails. It's possible to create jobs in our community that are clean, that are restorative to the environment, healing of the environment, solar energy, permaculture, biodiesel, all these different new technologies for clean energy and green products are now available. Well, who's going to get those jobs to make those technologies available? We're saying, as environmentalists and as criminal justice people, we want those clean, green jobs in our community. And let that be an alternative energy strategy, an alternative environmental strategy, and also an alternative community safety strategy.
Can you talk about the Apollo project? Sure. We were in New Hampshire for the campaign, the primaries, and saw a bunch of people dressed in orange jumpsuits.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, we're entering a third wave of environmentalism in this country. The first wave was the conservation Teddy Roosevelt wave, and then in the 60s you got the sort of conservation plus regulation wave as people began to be concerned about toxics. Now we're going into a third wave where it's conservation plus regulating the bad plus investing in the good, investing in solar, investing in hydrogen, investing in the things that we know will help the environment. The Apollo Project is a leading edge campaign that's getting labor and environmentalists together who've always been fighting and saying, look, let's not fight. Let's say the government, we want billions of dollars spent on clean energy jobs. That's a great new development. The Bioneers are on that track. Phil Angelides with his Green Wave initiative here in California trying to put $500 million of state pension money into green and sustainable business. Our initiative now, which we're calling Green Jobs, Not Jails, bringing the environmentalists and criminal justice together saying, hey, don't throw money and giving subsidies to polluters and incarcerators who make the problem worse. Spend that money on creating good jobs in our community. and jobs that will heal the environment and help restore the economic viability of our community. So, you know, what we're saying is, out of this crisis of over-incarceration, the public health crisis within the environmental situation, there's opportunity for new coalitions and a forward, vision-driven environmentalism, solution-driven environmentalism that connects with criminal justice. And that's what we're about.
Van Jones, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Your website?
Yes, ellabakercenter.org. That's ellabakercenter.org. People who are interested, especially in our April 28th candlelight vigil, to stand with the families of the young people who lost their lives in the youth prison system, please go to our website, ellabakercenter.org. Sign up, get involved.
Thank you very much for being with us. Also, Ray Leon, a policy analyst for environmental health issues at the new office of the Latino Issues Forum in the San Joaquin Valley. You are listening to and watching Democracy Now! On over 200 public access TV stations, Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, also broadcasting on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, and today for the first time broadcasting also on Link TV, Channel 9410 of Dish Network, also on DirecTV. This is Democracy Now! As we move into our last segment, the state of siege continuing in Fallujah, Iraq. Medical officials in the city said today some 15 Iraqis more have been killed by U.S. forces, 20 more wounded. Hundreds of people continue to flee Fallujah on a daily basis. But there are reports that the U.S. is only allowing women and children to leave. Last Friday, the Pentagon announced what it called a unilateral ceasefire. But the killings have gone on unabated. U.S. snipers occupy positions throughout the city. Arab satellite channels have been broadcasting images of many women and children killed and wounded by the U.S. military. Hospital officials in Fallujah are contradicting Pentagon reports on a daily basis about who's paying the price in Fallujah. Military has said that 95% of those killed are men of fighting age, but the doctors and the hospitals are painting a very different picture. Some estimates put the number of Iraqi dead in the city as high as 1,200. Meanwhile, six international activists who were held prisoner in Fallujah were just released. And as Free Speech Radio News correspondent Aaron Glantz reports from Baghdad, he had harsh words for the American occupation.
Australian aid worker Donna Malboon came to Fallujah on Tuesday as part of a group of six activists. Their goal was to use their foreign passports as a shield against U.S. Marine snipers posted around the city, which had been shooting at trucks attempting to bring medical aid to victims of the American assault. But the tactic didn't work.
We were accompanying an ambulance from one part of Fallujah to another area of Fallujah that was controlled by the Americans. We went along with the ambulance and at one stage got out of the ambulance to indicate to the Americans that we were coming through with an ambulance with aid for a clinic that had been cut off. We used a loudspeaker to identify ourselves. We were dressed in bright blue medical outfits and we had our passports in our hands with our hands in the air. Then we stepped forward into the street with our hands in the air. We were walking down away from where the soldiers were stationed. We didn't realize that, and they ended up shooting towards our backs.
In a letter to Free Speech Radio News, U.S. Marine Lieutenant Eric Knapp denied American forces ever fired on any vehicle bringing medical relief. He blamed Iraqi insurgents who he said were doing everything they can to prevent aid from reaching the needy. But Welsh activist Bethan Jones believes the American snipers knew they were shooting an ambulance.
It was a very obvious ambulance. It was one of the large transit type size ambulances. It had blue flashing lights. It was fully labeled as an ambulance. There was no doubt.
The inability of medical aid to move inside Fallujah is a major cause of civilian death in the city, according to activist Donna Malboon. At least 600 Fallujans have died since the American assault began, most of them civilian.
The problem is getting the people to the clinics. I mean, this is the whole point of why we went there, is that people are getting injured and then being unable to travel and get them to the hospital. We saw one guy being brought in who'd lost his arm, and he was just taken to the only clinic that they could get him to, which was our clinic, and because we hadn't been able to get to the hospital to pick up the supplies, there were no kits for dealing with him, and this guy died because there wasn't the medical services to deal with what had happened to him.
But it wasn't only the American Army that caused problems for Donna Malboon and her colleagues. She says on their way out of Fallujah, her group was stopped by Iraqi Mujahideen fighters who held them for 24 hours.
They wanted to know who we were at the beginning, and they investigated and they asked questions and they looked at our belongings, and once they realized what we were doing, they treated us with great respect.
Donna Malboon says the delegation was held in a large room and fed well during their detention. Bethan Jones says the topic of conversation quickly turned to the American assault on Fallujah, where the two groups found common ground.
They would be talking and saying, my brother's being killed, my father's being killed. They were telling us these tales so that we could understand the way that they were feeling and the obvious resentment that they were feeling to the occupation that they are now suffering, in that a year ago they were promised freedom and liberation from the Saddam regime, and now they're living in this situation where they do not have any freedom.
Back in the relative safety of Baghdad, Donna Malboon reflects on her temporary captivity. She doesn't hold any anger towards her captors.
Fallujah was under siege, and even the women and children who wanted to leave today and the men couldn't leave, and the bombardment from the air was constant, and the sniper activity was constant to the point where they were so terrified to leave their houses. These people were being captive in their own town, in their own country.
The U.S. Marine Corps attacked the city of Fallujah with F-15 fighter jets and AC-130 gunships today. A military spokesperson told Agence France-Presse the maneuvers were defensive. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
And that does it for today's program as we broadcast live from San Francisco, continuing our exception to the ruler's tour, shoring up community media around the country. Tonight at 7 o'clock, we'll be at an independent bookstore in San Francisco, a clean, well-lighted place. Tomorrow at noon, we'll be in Palo Alto with the Peace and Justice Center at the First Presbyterian Church. At 4 o'clock at Book Passage in Marin County. At 7 o'clock at Copperfields in Santa Rosa. On Sunday at the Rio Theater in Santa Cruz. And we go on from there. You can just check our website at www.democracynow.org/book as we continue with the exception to the ruler's tour. It is very exciting to be meeting people at community radio and television stations around the country. And in a time of the largest media consolidation this country has ever seen, to be standing with independent media, shoring up independent media around this country. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill. Very special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Karen Renucci. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our director is Uri Galed. We have lots of people to thank who are a part of this expanded team today. Thank you to Ms. M from KPFA, who helped to record the Michael Franti event last night as we celebrated KPFA. And special thanks to the studios here, Mark Erickson and the crew here at Media One Studio in San Francisco, Kim Spencer, Heather Harford of Link TV, and Free Speech TV, broadcasting on Dish Network as well, channel 9415. Go to our website, democracynow.org, as we go out today with more of Michael Franti. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Upon you when your sun has gone away. And I believe that what you dream